Well, if we sang those songs, I was just thinking, if we can't worship singing those songs, we just didn't come to worship. It's what great songs. And we are talking tonight about trials of our faith. And some of the trials of our faith are the afflictions and troubles that we face. And that'll be one of the points that I'll be making. And all of these songs surely encourage us as we face various trials and afflictions in our life. Thank you for your presence. It's been such an encouraging week to me. I believe it has been to the Westview Church, and I believe that those of you who have come hopefully have been encouraged and strengthened, and it just means so much for you to be here. It's hard to overstate the importance of faith. Faith is what gives substance to our hope. Hebrews 11:1, faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. But hope is the anchor of the soul. Hebrews 6, verse 19, somewhere in there. So if a person loses his faith, he loses his hope. And when he loses his hope, he has nothing to hold on to in all the troubles that he faces in life. I feel sorry for a person who's lost his faith. But faith can be tested severely. What I want to do tonight is talk about some of the tests of faith. We'll mention four. And then look back at one man who faced every one of these tests and who held on to his faith all the way through. So let's talk about various tests of our faith. First of all, I would suggest harsh criticism can test our faith. And if you really get on fire for the Lord, don't be surprised if somebody criticizes you. Who does he think he is? What's he trying to show off about? He's just trying to show the rest of us up. You hate to think that such things are said, but sometimes that's kind of the way people react when they see somebody who really gets intense in his service to the Lord. And it can be discouraging. Let's get our Bibles. Turn to Matthew 26. So much of the criticism that is given is unjust. And this is one of those cases. Matthew 26, let's begin with verse 6. And when Jesus was in Bethany at the house of Simon the leper, a woman came to him having an alabaster flask of very costly fragrant oil. And she poured it on his head as he sat at the table. But when his disciples saw it, they were indignant, saying, "Why this waste? For this fragrant oil might have been sold for much and given to the poor." But when Jesus was aware of it, he said to them, "Why do you trouble the woman? For she has done a good work for me. For you have the poor with you always, but me you do not have always. For in pouring this fragrant oil on my body, she did it for my burial. Assuredly, I say to you, wherever this gospel is preached in the whole world, what this woman has done will also be told as a memorial for her." Unjust criticism. And it's coming from Jesus' apostles, led, as most of you know, by Judas, we're told in the book of John. Jesus defended her. And I wonder how many times, if we find ourselves criticizing somebody because he's become so active in the Lord's work, if the Lord were among us, he would defend them. But it's a test of our faith. Here's a second test of faith. And that's when we've fallen into sin. Turn to Luke 22. Verse 31. Luke 22, verse 31. The Lord said, "Simon, Simon, indeed Satan has asked for you that he may sift you as wheat. But I've prayed for you that your faith should not fail. And when you have returned to me, strengthen your brethren. This is in regards to Peter's denial of the Lord. And did you notice Jesus didn't say, I'm praying for you that you won't deny me. He was going to deny him. Jesus was saying that. But Jesus knew that when we fall into sin, it's a real test of our faith, and he doesn't want Peter's faith to fail when he sins against him. There's a number of reasons why our faith is tested when we sin. Sometimes it's because of embarrassment. And especially if it's somebody that people have looked up to and thought, here's one of the strongest people we have in the church. And then one day he does something that nobody thought he would ever do. He never thought himself he would ever do. And he is so embarrassed by what's taken place. And then other times a person may be discouraged. He struggled so hard to live for the Lord, and here he has failed again, and he may be saying to himself, what's the use? There's no use in me trying to serve the Lord. I can't do it. And then there may be those who brood over their sins, wonder if God's really forgiven them. Maybe worried, maybe my brothers and sisters have not really forgiven me. Turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 2. You remember a man in Corinth had fallen into sin. And in the first letter to the Corinthians, Paul had told them to withdraw from him and that his soul may be saved. And apparently by the time we get to 2 Corinthians, he has repented. Now here are the instructions. Look at verse 6. This punishment which was inflicted by the majority is sufficient for such a man. So that on the contrary, you ought rather to forgive and comfort him, lest perhaps such a man be swallowed up with too much sorrow. Therefore, I urge you to reaffirm your love to him. For to this end, I also wrote that I might put you to the test, whether you're obedient in all things. Now, whom you forgive anything, I also forgive. For if indeed I have forgiven anything, I have forgiven that one for your sakes in the presence of Christ. Lest Satan should take advantage of us. We're not ignorant of his devices. Forgive that man. Don't hold him at arm's length. Forgive him and let him know he's forgiven. Encourage him, strengthen him. We're not ignorant of Satan's devices. Here's the third thing I would suggest, and this is what we've already mentioned. The troubles and difficulties, unfair treatment that people give us in life almost on a daily basis, they can really test our faith. And in fact, that may be the strongest test of our faith. I'm turning to 1 Peter chapter 1. Peter speaks of the salvation of the soul. Tells us the object of our hope. And then he says, verse 6, in this you greatly rejoice, though now for a little while, if need be, you have been grieved by various trials, that the genuineness of your faith, being much more precious than gold that perishes, though it is tested by fire, may be found to praise, honor, and glory at the revelation of Jesus Christ. So we serve the Lord. We seek to be faithful to him, to do his will. And we read, I will never leave you nor forsake you. We pray to him. And then one day, everything turns sour. We lose our job. About the time we lose our job, sickness hits in the family. It just seems like we're overwhelmed with troubles. We look around and hear people who do not even serve the Lord, and looks like everything's going their way, we may begin to wonder, well, where is God? And we would not be the first. Turn to Psalm 73. Psalm 73 is written by a good man. In fact, I've looked at some of the Psalms. The man's name is Asaph. And I've looked at some of the Psalms, and I thought, maybe a good sermon would be to just kind of look through the Psalms written by Asaph and draw some conclusions and see what a good man this is. But as we read this Psalm, he's struggling. Look at verse 1. Truly God is good to Israel, to such as are pure in heart. But as for me, my feet had almost stumbled. My steps had nearly slipped. For I was envious of the boastful when I saw the prosperity of the wicked. There are no pangs in their death, but their strength is firm. They are not in trouble as other men, nor are they plagued like other men. Therefore pride serves as their necklace. Violence covers them like a garment. Their eyes bulge with abundance. They have more than heart could wish. Look at verse 13. Asaph says, surely I've cleansed my heart in vain and washed my hands in innocence. For all day long I've been plagued and chastened every morning. What good has it done me to serve the Lord? Look at all these people out here, and they're wicked, and they have no interest in God at all, and everything's going their way, and here I am, and I'm suffering. And he said, I almost slipped. Look at verse 16. When I thought how to understand this, it was too painful for me until I went into the sanctuary of God. Then I understood their end. Surely you set them in slippery places. You cast them down to destruction. Oh, how they're brought to desolation is it in a moment. They're utterly consumed with terrors. Finally, he catches hold of himself. I want to tell you, it doesn't matter how many troubles come into our life. And I know I'm talking to people who face troubles all the time, and I've had my share, and you know that. But whatever troubles we ever face, if we're Christians, we can all sing with all of our heart, God is so good. God is so good. God is so good. He's so good to me. And all of us, if we'll just think about it, know how wonderful God has been to all of us. Well, here's a fourth test of our faith. And that's when our children disappoint us. That's a big test too. We teach our children. We try to set a good example before them. We give them a peaceful environment in the home in which they can grow up. We take them regularly to worship and to Bible classes. And then when they get grown, they turn their backs on everything we've taught them. That hurts. Then we read passages like Proverbs 22:6, train up a child in the way he should go, and when he's old, he will not depart from it. And we look around, and other people's children are all just very faithful to the Lord, and we begin to ask ourselves, well, where did I go wrong? Maybe I'm not the Christian I ought to be. And many a person has grown discouraged, faith shaken, because their children turned their backs on Christ and all of everything they had been taught. Well, those are four pretty major tests of our faith, and I think everybody here would agree to that. But now I want to look at one man who faced every one of these tests. But when it was all said and done, he maintained his faith. You may be already running ahead of me. That one man is David. Let's just look and see him face every one of those tests. First of all, I'm going to 1 Samuel chapter 17. Israel is in battle with the Philistines. And David is still at home taking care of the sheep. But his father sends some supplies and food to David's brothers. And when David gets there, that's when Goliath issues his challenge. Not the first time, but he hears the challenge of Goliath. And David asks the question. Verse 26. Then David spoke to the men who stood by him, saying, "What should be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" Who is this man? Well, his brother hurt him. Look at verse 28. Now Eliab, his brother, heard when he spoke to the men, and Eliab's anger was aroused against David. And he said, "Why did you come down here? And with whom have you left these few feet sheep in the wilderness? I know your pride and the insolence of your heart, for you come down to see the battle." And David said, "What have I done now? Is there not a cause?" Unjust criticism. Harsh criticism. And it's coming from his own brother. David knew what that was. David knew what it was to fall into sin. You know that. Turn to 2 Samuel 11. Do you remember how it all came about? David was on the housetop toward evening. He looked over and there was a beautiful woman bathing. What should David have done? Obviously, he was tempted. He was tempted to look and to lust after her. But if he had said to himself, "That's not my wife. I have no right to stand here and lust after her." And if he walked away, never to come back again to that spot, hoping to see her again, then that would have been the very thing God wanted him to do. But that's not what he did. He allowed himself to stand there and to lust for her. And then he sent for her and he committed adultery with her. And then the word came back, "I'm with child." Well, you can almost imagine the horror that David would have felt. Now it's time to see if I can cover that up. So he brings Uriah home from the army. Uriah is the husband. He tries to get Uriah to go down to his wife. He doesn't go down. So he sends a letter to Joab by Uriah himself. Put Uriah in the fiercest part of the battle. Uriah is killed. The word comes back, and David takes Bathsheba for his wife. And hopefully, it's all covered up. Nobody will ever know. Look at the last sentence in 2 Samuel chapter 11. "But the thing that David had done displeased the Lord." The Lord saw it. We don't hide anything from him. We may be able to hide things from all of the other people, but here's David, the king, the one who wrote the 23rd Psalm, the one people looked up to. And now what's happened? God sent Nathan. I don't know how long there was between his sin and the time of Nathan's coming. If there's any indication, I don't know it. I wonder how long there was. But Nathan the prophet comes to David and gives him this little parable that you surely are familiar with. There's a rich man and poor man living side by side. The rich man has multitudes of sheep and cattle, and the poor man has one little ewe lamb that he's bought and nourished just like a daughter to him. And visitors come to the rich man. Instead of taking from his own flocks and herds, he goes and takes that poor man's one little ewe lamb. Well, David is just so angry. The man who's done this, I believe this idea probably is, he ought to die and he will pay fourfold. He's just so angry. Isn't it terrible? That we can always see somebody else's sin but have so much trouble seeing our own. Here's David angry because a rich man has taken another man's little ewe lamb and David has taken a man's wife and killed him in taking his wife. But David's not thinking about that. And Nathan says, "You're the man." I like David's reply. Look at verse 13 of 2 Samuel 12. So David said to Nathan, I have sinned against the Lord. And Nathan said to David, the Lord also has put away your sin. You shall not die. You know what I like about that? David offered no excuses. He didn't blame Bathsheba. He didn't offer any alibis. He didn't play the victim card, which is, people are so skillful in our day of playing, and even Christians. He didn't play the victim card. He just said, I have sinned. Folks, that's the way we approach sin in our life. Not covering it up. No matter how embarrassed we are, no excuses, no alibis, no trying to make somebody else look worse than we are, just I've sinned. And that's what David said. Can you imagine the hurt as he listened to the next words? Verse 14. However, because by this deed you have given great occasion to the enemies of the Lord to blaspheme, the child also is born to you shall surely die. The child's going to die. And you, David, you have given occasion to the enemies of the Lord to blaspheme. And David loved the Lord. I cannot imagine the hurt that would have been David's as he heard those words. But you know, we're not told, but I suspect that in some ways he was relieved. It's now in the open. No more covering up. No more looking at this one and wondering if this one knows about it, and wonder if this one knows about it. Maybe this one, who? David had been miserable. Again, I don't know how long it was between his sin and Nathan's coming. But David had been miserable. Turn to the 32nd Psalm. Psalm 32. In Psalm 32, David is rejoicing over his forgiveness. But notice what he says in verses 3 and 4. Let's start with verse 1. Blessed is he whose transgression is forgiven, whose sin is covered. Blessed is the man to whom the Lord does not impute iniquity, and in whose spirit there is no deceit. Now listen, when I kept silent, my bones grew old through my groaning all the day long. For day and night your hand was heavy upon me. My vitality was turned into the drought of summer. That's how it is. When we have unconfessed sin, we're covering it up. We're miserable. And I can't help but think that now that Nathan has exposed him, that there's a sense of relief and the assurance that God has forgiven him. But what a test of faith. I think we have time to do this. Turn to the 51st Psalm. And here's David pleading with God. You know, am I correct in saying there is a difference in being forgiven and in having full restoration? Sometimes it takes a little time. David is immediately assured by Nathan, your sin is forgiven. But here he is pleading for full restoration. Look at verse 7. Purge me with hyssop and I shall be clean. Wash me and I shall be whiter than snow. Make me hear joy and gladness, that the bones you have broken may rejoice. Hide your face from my sins and blot out all my iniquities. Create in me a clean heart, O God, and renew a steadfast spirit within me. Do not cast me away from your presence, and do not take your Holy Spirit from me. Restore to me the joy of your salvation, and uphold me by your generous spirit. David wants full joy that he had known in the past. A real test of faith. Well, David knew what afflictions were. Troubles. People treating you unfairly. Remember how he had to flee from Saul and hide out in mountains and caves and wherever he could find to hide out, and even had to go take care of his mother and dad. It wasn't the king of Moab, I believe it was, he went to take care of his mother and dad. That's the kind of affliction he went through. And then later, Absalom leads a rebellion against his father, takes over the kingdom. Go to 2 Samuel 15. Here's a sad picture. 2 Samuel 15. This is in regards to Absalom's rebellion. Look at verse 30. So David went up by the ascent of the Mount of Olives and wept as he went up, and he had his head covered and went barefoot. And all the people who were with him covered their heads and went up weeping as they went up. And then news, bad news, comes to David. Look at verse 31. Then someone told David, saying, Ahithophel is among the conspirators with Absalom. And David said, O Lord, I pray, turn the counsel of Ahithophel into foolishness. Who was Ahithophel? His primary counselor, his special friend. He'd gone to the house of God with him, one of the Psalms says. When your friends turn against you, it hurts, doesn't it? David went through all of that. He knew what troubles and afflictions were. And David knew what it was to be disappointed in your children. Amnon, his son, raped his own half-sister. And then Absalom turns around and kills Amnon. And then Absalom leads the rebellion we've just been talking about and takes the kingdom away from David, and he's killed in the battle. And then another son, Adonijah, toward the end of David's life, competes with Solomon for the kingship, even though God had clearly said that Solomon would be the one who would follow David. Disappointment in his children. Do you see that David went through all these tests of faith? And yet the wonderful truth is, he never lost his faith. He maintained his faith in God through it all. Turn back to 1 Samuel 17. This is the passage where Goliath makes his challenge, where David's older brother, oldest brother, criticized him. But David didn't let any of that stand in his way. Maybe that's a good point for us to make. Yeah, people are going to criticize you when you really get on fire for the Lord. Don't let it stop you. And David did not. So he went to Saul, brought to Saul, and Saul said, well, wait a minute, you can't do this. Listen to verse 37. Moreover, David said, the Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine. And Saul said to David, go and the Lord be with you. David wasn't going to go against Goliath on the basis of his own strength. He knew that better than that. He's depending on the Lord. Then you go on down to verse 45. And as he approaches Goliath kind of looks with disdain on him. Listen to verse 45. Then David said to the Philistine, You come to me with a sword, with a spear, and with a javelin. But I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you and take your head from you. And this day I will give the carcasses of the camp of the Philistines to the birds of the air and the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. Then all this assembly shall know that the Lord does not save with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands. Where's David's faith? Not in himself. Not in his sling and stone. His faith is in God. And his older brother's criticism doesn't shake his faith at all. I'm just choosing passages. Go to Psalm 46. David, is your faith in place? Do you still have your faith? Let's read Psalm 46. May not read all of it, but listen to him. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore, we will not fear, even though the earth be removed, and though the mountains be carried into the midst of the sea, though its waters roar and be troubled, though the mountains shake with its swelling. There is a river whose stream shall make glad the city of God, the holy place of the tabernacle of the Most High. God is in the midst of her. She shall not be moved. God shall help her just at the break of dawn. The nations raged. The kingdoms were removed. He uttered his voice. The earth melted. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. David's faith shaken. No. I will give you this little bit of an aside. December 7, 1941. Pearl Harbor has just been attacked. It's Sunday morning. Franklin T. Puckett, whom I admired greatly and who introduced Charlotte and me, he actually played Cupid pretty hard, was on his way to worship when he heard the news. He knew the people would not be able to listen to his sermon that day that he had prepared. He scrapped it and turned to Psalm 46 and gave encouragement and help to that group of people that Sunday morning at Pearl Harbor. And he used that psalm that we just read. Well, let me take it one more passage. 1 Chronicles chapter 29. By this time, David is near death. Has he been able to maintain his faith? He's been through a lot. He's had harsh criticism, disappointment in his children. He's been through so much, all those troubles and afflictions. Does he still have his faith? Well, in 1 Chronicles 29, he is nearing death. You remember God did not allow him to build the temple, but he was going to allow Solomon, his son, to build the temple. And David amassed a huge amount of wealth, materials for the temple that Solomon was going to be building. And he encouraged other people to bring, and people brought liberally offerings that would go into the building of that temple. And here is David's worship to God. Verse 10, beginning of 1 Chronicles 29. Therefore David blessed the Lord before all the assembly. And David said, "Blessed are you, Lord God of Israel, our Father, forever and ever. Yours, O Lord, is the greatness, the power, and the glory, the victory, and the majesty. For all that is in heaven and in earth is yours. Yours is the kingdom of O Lord, and you are exalted as head above all. Both riches and honor come from you, and you reign over all. In your hand is power and might. In your hand it is to make great and to give strength to all. Now, therefore, our God, we thank you and praise your glorious name. But who am I and who are my people that we should be able to offer so willingly as this? For all things come from you, and of your own we have given you. For we're aliens and pilgrims before you, as were all our fathers. All our days on earth are as a shadow and without hope. Does David still have his faith through everything he'd gone through? He still has his faith. And he serves as a marvelous example to us. Don't let anything destroy your faith. Whatever you go through, hold on tightly to your faith. For when you finally lose your faith, you've lost everything. We know this song, I think. And in our book, it is to the tune of "I'm not ashamed to own my Lord." Hint, hint. Here's what the song says. Oh, for a faith that will not shrink, though pressed by every foe, that will not tremble on the brink of any earthly woe. A faith that shines more bright and clear when tempests rage without, that when in danger knows no fear, in darkness feels no doubt. Lord, give us such a faith as this, and then whatever may come, we'll taste in here the hallowed bliss of an eternal home. That's the kind of faith I want. And I want the kind of faith that David had. Can we just sing that as a closing song tonight? That would be really good. One more remark before we sing our invitation song. No matter how much we may believe, no matter what we may say about our faith, faith must act. Faith without works is dead. You know that. I wonder how many people in this audience have faith, but they've never put it into action. Never maybe confessed faith and been baptized. Maybe have done that in the past, but you really need to come back to the Lord. Let your faith move you to obey the Lord and to find forgiveness in Him. We stand and sing.